This episode was recorded in March, but because of constraints on our editors, we were not able to produce it until now. Therefore, the news included is out of date, but it's still really cool, so we decided to leave it in.
Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by Dragonmount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series written by Robert Jordan. There are currently 11 novels in the main series, as well as one prequel novel.
Sadly, in September of 2007, as he was working on finishing the series, Robert Jordan lost a long and hard-fought battle.
However, despite the loss of its creator, the wheel turns on. Harriet Rigney, Mr. Jordan's widow and chief editor, has appointed noted author Brandon Sanderson to complete the final novel entitled A Memory of Light.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Fourth Age podcast brought to you by Dragonmount.com. I'm Andrew Gellos, and with us, as usual, is Virginia.
Hello, everyone. This is Virginia, and with us today we also have Jesse.
Hello, everyone. Very happy to be here. I believe we also have Mark with us tonight.
Hi, everyone.
So we're going to go into the college-level courses today. The geophysical ramification, the geopolitical ramifications of the White Tower versus the Black Tower and the Shan Chan versus everyone else.
Yes. For all you scientists out there, that just means what the world's going to look like and who's going to be talking to who after the last battle. One thing I would like to make mention, we are going to be discussing various things all the way through all 11 books and the prequel novels, so there are going to be spoilers. So if you haven't read the whole series, you might not want to listen to this podcast.
Yep, that's for sure. So, okay, we'll just start out. Who do you think is going to survive as a nation? Which nation do you think is going to survive the last battle and continue to be a power in the post-Tarmogoyen world? Mark, what do you think?
Well, I don't want to steal Andrew's thunder since I know what he's going to talk about, so I will pick random other country that I think will survive. And that will actually be an amalgamation between Ilion and Tyr. That may not be called Ilion and Tyr at the end of it, but I have a sneaky suspicion that those two nations will somehow either merge themselves, mesh, be forced into dealing with each other, be known as the new Randland, something of the like. But they will survive the last battle in some way, shape, or form between the two, because we've got super stubborn sailor Ilions, and we have the Stone of Tyr. I mean, two things that probably will fight to their very last breath and then some before they actually fail and vanish. So those two things together will make some fancy-smancy thing that will survive.
Well, and how is Maine going to figure into that? Are they going to be cornered by a nation that's now twice as large as Tyr? Or do you think that Rand will manage to give Berylaine some additional power and lands?
She might end up taking over that country. Actually, I don't think so, because Darlin is king of one and Rand is king of the other. But actually, my personal hope is that Maine gets smushed, flattened, drowned, whatever, it's gone. There's no such thing as Maine anymore.
I think that that might be a possibility, but at the same time, I think that, and I don't know if anybody else has mentioned this before, but Berylaine, one of her names is Sir Pandrag. She is going to, in my personal opinion, be absolutely crucial to dealing with the Shan Chen, because she is a direct descendant of Hawkwing.
I agree. That's exactly what I was going to say. I think she's going to be exalted by whatever powers of the Shan Chen that survive in Randland, and possibly be a link in Rand's desire to join the West and the South and the East and all the different factions and everything. I think she's going to be a powerful link along with Tuon and Mat, maybe joining the Shan Chan to the existing nations in some sort of a harmonious blend.
True, and that's a very good idea. But if she's going to get exalted by the Shan Chan, then she doesn't need Maine, so it can just drown.
No, that's what the drowned lands do. They're already drowned, so they don't need to have Maine go as well. It's such a little country, I can't imagine why you would even care.
I've just never really liked Berylaine. She just always struck me as the predator cat that just wouldn't back off and was just right royally pissing everybody off. And I've had to deal with that kind of personality in its adolescent form many a time back through my years in high school. And seeing it written out in book from somebody who is, technically, if I remember correctly, she is like my age or just slightly older. And I gave up on high school a long time ago, so I mean, that just bugs me.
Well, see, I kind of view Maine as sort of the Las Vegas of Randland. I think it's one of the places where anybody could go, and things are a little bit looser, and you know, they can get away with a lot more and everything, so I think maybe it could be the new pleasure destination from the post-Tarman Gaiden world. You know, what happens in Maine stays in Maine.
I have never looked at Maine quite like that, but I see what you could be saying. I think that with Bear Lane out of the picture as far as ruling it, it wouldn't surprise me at all if it was swallowed up with maybe Tyr and Ilion, as Mark mentioned, joining together as one big supernation or somehow kind of all uniting together.
And Maine will be the capital and rule over them both.
I could actually see that as being a real possibility, actually. I've been kind of thinking over everything as far as the various nations. I do think Tyr and Ilion...
...that's bi-curious or...
Do remember that
bi,
he also has a wife, so he has to
them, be it's even
careful
more fun.
What he says when he says it.
To see mine just being kind of absorbed into it. I am 50-50 on Kyrian. I don't know. I could see it surviving, but then I could also see it being annexed into Andor, because I do believe Andor will survive regardless if Elaine lives or not. As far as Bear Lane's role, I've kind of been looking at the strife that's now happening with the Shanshan. Unfortunately, it's barely even known by the end of the 11th book that the Empress and the entire royal family, aside from, or imperial family rather, aside from Tuan is dead. There's absolutely no one left but her to take the throne, but everyone in Sandir and the Shanshan homelands are all in a massive state of civil war right now, all vying for the Crystal Throne. So Tuan has to actually get a hold of her nation before they're going to be a cohesive force like they have been in previous books.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I think that that's going to be an interesting situation, and I find it very interesting that Mad is now so central to the Shanshan Imperial family as well, being Prince of the Ravens. It's going to be interesting to see what his part is in it. And going back to Berylane, I also find it funny that not only is she probably going to be at least admired or accepted by the Shanshan because of her heritage and direct link to Archer Hawkwing, but she's also widely accepted by the Aiel. The Wise Ones treat her as a daughter of their tents, and I think that she could actually end up being a really central figure in melding together the lands that are left after Tarman Gaiden. It's kind of funny when we consider that she was introduced to us as originally kind of a lightweight.
Yeah, literally. One other thing about her that I don't remember now exactly what it's from, if it's one of Min's viewings or one of Egwene's dreams, but she's also going to, I think it was, the quote was, fall in love with somebody who was very beautiful. And I have always thought that that hinted at Glad. And if she is able to, between the Wise Ones, the remaining White Cloaks, and the Shanshan, she could be a very uniting power and a very uniting force come Tarman Gaiden.
Which is kind of scary when you consider how really annoying she can be. Yeah, it was mentioned that she would be swept off her feet by a man in white, and I've always assumed that was Skellige as well. So there's another connection between the royal line of Andor and Archer Hawkwing and the Shanshan and maybe the Aiel. It's really kind of interesting. I don't know what he's going to make out of that, but I'll bet it's going to be something we're not expecting.
No kidding. But also, if I remember correctly, I think it was a Min's viewing that was talking about that. But if I remember correctly, it also talked that not only would she be swept off her feet, but she'd sort of be strung along like she always strings all the other guys along. So I found that to be a really neat, neat thing, that the sort of phrase, you get what you give, and karma's going to come, and it's going to bite her hard.
That's very possible.
Speaking of connections between Andor and Maine and Andor and Kyrian, the various other nations, I'm also kind of interested in seeing how the entire promise Perrin made to the Shanshan sits with the new Queen of Andor. If you really think about it, Perrin promised the Kingdom of Manethrin to the Shanshan, and most of Manethrin's lands lie in the Kingdom of Andor now. So it's kind of one of those things I'm trying to figure out, you know, is Elaine going to be somewhat gracious and allow part of her domain to slip if she can do something like annex Kyrian, or is she going to fight tooth and nail, and, you know, what's that going to end up doing to relations in a world that's probably going to be pretty turbulent after the last battle.
See, I think that if Elaine was aware of this at this particular moment, then she would fight tooth and nail. But I don't think she's going to have a chance or an opportunity to. And I think going back to the original question of what lands are going to essentially remain after the last battle, I think that Manethrin is going to be one of them.
That's a neat thought. Resurrecting Manethrin is always been something I've kind of been tying in the back of my mind going, ooh, bring back Manethrin, chunk out Andor, chunk out Farmadding, and all the other country that surrounds that one. If I remember correctly, that's not Lugard, I can't even
Murindi.
Remember. Murindi, that's it. Grab in Murindi, grab in the area north of Andor between it and the Borderlands, possibly grab a chunk of Arad Doman.
Well, and when you think about it, the resurrection of Manethrin has been a constant threat since, I want to say, almost book 3, when you think about it. People are always talking about how, you know, the banner of Manethrin, you know, flying is this huge thing that everyone's worried about because it was a massive nation. And you know, when it fell apart into the kingdoms that now exist, or actually it was into several other kingdoms, which then later fell into other kingdoms that now exist, but, you know, anyway, you got to kind of wonder. I mean, everyone's kind of like, oh, shoot, if it comes back, what's that going to do to all of us? Because I think Amadisia's part of it, what used to be Manethrin, Andor's, at least a chunk of it, was in Manethrin. You know, there's a lot of nations that actually were a part of Manethrin.
Gael'dan, I think, was as well part of it. If they bring Manethrin back, I kind of envision the fact that that might be a country that Perrin, as the Wolf King, might actually be able to sort of retire to and rule with Ba'il. Because I don't know that she's going to go back to the Borderlands. Unless Tenobia dies and Davern Bashir dies, she's not going to inherit the Broken Crown. They're really too far apart to merge those nations. Perhaps that could be a way to bring back Manethrin, is to have Perrin rule over that.
This is where my thought actually kind of diverges. I don't think Perrin's getting Manethrin. I actually do think that both Davram and Tenobia are going to die, that Perrin's going to take the Broken Crown and rule Saldia and whatever other borderland nations might get absorbed into it. And Matt will end up ruling Manethrin, even though he might not want to, because the lands of Manethrin were promised to the Seanchan by Perrin in the first place.
Oh, that's a thought. I like that. Yeah. I can't see Matt wanting to rule, but I have a feeling he's going to get dragged into it whether he likes it or not.
Just like he was thinking that way about royalty and the various elite. He always hated nobles and that stuff. And then, as he quotes himself later on, I hate them, but I bloody well married one.
Yeah, he'd rather marry a pig than a noblewoman, you know. Now he's going to marry royalty. That's even worse. He said that he thought that everything that went for noblewomen went 10 times more for royalty.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. I think that I had always kind of figured that whether Perrin wants to or not, he is, in effect, already started the process to raise Manethrin. And even though that's obviously not his goal, and he still thinks it's just going to kind of fall by the wayside and everybody will forget about it. But I really like that theory about Matt, and I could really see that as kind of a... almost like a comic irony that Matt ends up ruling this grand nation that comes out of the ashes of the last battle and doesn't really want to.
Could you imagine, how that country would be run? That's just scary. You've got a gambler, a rogue, a guy who likes to chase pretty women, catch pretty women, hell, sometimes get caught by pretty women, running a country?
I think Tuan's going to put a stop to a lot of that action, though, somehow. But maybe it'll be the new Monte Carlo to go with the Vegas of Maine.
You know, I think Tuan's actually kind of already started that process, because there's some pretty strong indications in Knife of Dreams that Matt's feelings about things in general, I mean, even though he bemoans, you know, I'm the person who goes and, you know, likes to have a different woman on my knee kind of thing, he does show some pretty strong feelings towards Tuan throughout their weird and, albeit, I
absolutely loved it, you know, comic sort of courtship ritual, like with the razor and, you know, with various other things and the little flowers made of cloth and the final, like, the red silk rose and everything. It just kind of seems to be an interesting thing. And I think that whether Matt realizes it or not, I think he's headed towards that sort of, you know, I'm really a one-woman guy and I'm actually going to be sticking with her because, you know, lo and behold, I didn't think it was possible, but hey, I actually love her.
Don't forget the fact that it started off with the abduction of his wife-to-be. That was the funniest part about the whole courtship. He abducted her. She kicked his ass, and he abducted her.
Yeah, but he's actually really starting to fall in love with her. He's starting to think about her in whole different ways, like as Andrew said. And I think, you know, obviously Matt has a lot more honor and responsibility than he gives himself credit for. He always talks himself into doing the right thing, even though he wants to go off and play and be irresponsible and doesn't see himself as a responsible person. He always ends up doing the right thing. He never goes skiving off to do foolish, silly things instead of what he's supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I actually think that Matt would make a very good ruler because he also has all kinds of memories from specifically men who have done, you know, some pretty fantastic deeds. So I think he would, with that benefit, I think he would make a very good ruler.
He also has the common touch. You know, he's really good dealing with people. He understands what it is to be a farmer and a peasant and all these other things, and he understands what it is to be a military leader. I think he'll really do well ruling a nation if he can ever sit himself down to do it.
But there's a lot of experience both in almost any other fantasy thing you look at, and also I could draw reference to current day. Military leaders do not necessarily... And I say not necessarily because Matt might just make a great leader, but most military leaders do not make good rulers. I mean, prime example, look to the south. Take a look at any kind of dictatorship, any kind of tyranny, any kind of government that has been run primarily by a military man, and look how that country has turned out in modern day times. I mean, you could probably take a look at some various things in various other fantasies and stuff.
No, I agree with you, and I think even if I maybe go back into the Wheel of Time, Elaine said that there is a difference between ruling and leading, and she's absolutely right, and I think that sometimes military leaders do not make good rulers, but I think Matt is really, he's a military leader sort of dragged kicking and screaming into it. He acquired that because of his past lives, you know, being the son of battles, as the Elfin called him. But he has all these memories of men. That's basically how he turns out to be a leader. I don't think that's his natural desire or bent, and that's the difference between him and most military leaders. He never sought to be a military leader. He didn't want the power or the authority or the responsibility. It was sort of thrust on him, and he just rose to the occasion.
Yeah, and Matt also, like we already mentioned, has Tuon. With her help and with her, you know, experience, she has been essentially trained from birth to rule an empire. So between the two of them, they could probably be very, very good leaders, very good rulers, take, you know, very good care of their citizens. I think that her attitude would be the typical Sean Chen, everything is strict and regimented, and Matt would obviously take some of that out of her, and together, though, they would really make a good team, I think.
Yeah, he should be able to soften some of her attitudes, and she should be able to give him advice on how, you know, she's been brought up with the idea of ruling a nation, much as Elaine was, so she should be able to give him all kinds of good ideas about how to deal with the things that he's going to have to deal with. And I think probably the same with Perrin. Fael has an idea of how to, you know, run things. She's been brought up in a family that's been a ruling family for a long time, so they should be. And the other thing I was just thinking is that, you know, now in the post-Harmongiden world, presumably a lot of Aes Sedai and Ashaman will be surviving as well. They're going to have the ability to travel amongst the different countries instantaneously and possibly have new Tarangriel and things, so that communications won't be matters of months anymore. So he would be able to draw on some of the experiences of some of the people that he's become close to, like Elaine and other people, if they survive, and, you know, be able to draw on other people's experience and help them. They can help each other in the post-Harmongiden world.
Yeah, the only thing that's going to need is just to bring back a nice, fun, secondary character. Bring back Satal Anan, and life will be great, because she was a very good influence on Tuon to help her adapt to what we call Randland way of life, and bring her back as an advisor, and their country is going to be awesome.
I already decided that Satala Anan was going to be Tuon's new tooth speaker to replace the disgusting Anoth, who is Semirag.
I like that idea a lot. I think that would be great.
Yeah, I think she'd be a natural for it.
What you're proposing, then, is that the new empress take a former Aes Sedai as her truth speaker. I think there's a delicious amount of irony for both of them, particularly because I was half convinced that eventually someone's going to find out and actually restore Satel's ability to channel.
I think you're right, too, but I think that Tuan's going to be the catalyst to change a lot of the Shanshan ideas about channelers. They may not be able to continue with the Mani in the way that they are. They may not embrace Aes Sedai the way that Ramban does, but I think they're going to have to see some changes. And I can't see that structure continuing on unless they manage to maintain it actually in Shandar and the country of Shanshan and things run differently over in Ranland. I don't know necessarily if Tuan is going to stay here. She's going to want to go back and rule her country, whether Matt goes with her or not.
I'm pretty sure he'll end up going with her, because despite the fact that he hates nobility and royalty and stuff like that, he has this thing, and Swan pointed it out to him one point, that he will do the right thing. It might hurt him, he might rail against it when he thinks about it, but when the time comes, he'll do the right thing. And to me, that means he'll go with her, be the good Prince of the Ravens, be the good co-ruler, sub-ruler, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I agree.
To a sort of, I don't want to say change directions, but slightly shift them. We got onto this topic by discussing the rebirth of Manethrin, and in the topic of kingdoms that are dead that may or may not get resurrected, what do people think about the resurrection of Malkir?
Oh, I think that's pretty much a given, partly because of, well, we don't know that it had any relation to reality, but in Nynaeve's accepted test, you know, she had that entire vision of a resurrected Malkier, and she and Lan, the king and queen. And I think that's certainly possible, particularly if they have a decisive triumph in Tarmogaidon, and they can beat the Blight back and recover those lands. I could certainly see Lan and Nynaeve ruling there.
I don't know if it'll beat back the Blight, but I'm thinking that the Borderlands shall merge, blend, whatever, and they might gain back some of the Blight enough that you can get back the Crown City of Malkier, but I think that the whole Borderlands will become a single Borderland of Malkier.
I don't see that, because they have such individual national identities in a lot of ways. I mean, they don't really go into them a lot, but they are very different cultures, and I can't see any real reason for them to merge, especially if the imminent threat of the Blight isn't there. That's basically why they've been so cohesive at this point, because they had a common foe to fight. I think if peace comes, they'll just continue to thrive as individual nations.
I think that some of them are going to have to merge together, and I don't really know if I have a whole lot to base that on. I don't think that many of the countries that exist as they do before the last battle are going to exist in the same way after the last battle. I think that there is going to be enough geopolitical upheaval, if you will, to, you know, eliminate many of them.
I guess it'll depend on how many physical changes take part in the land, if the actual lands are destroyed or substantially altered, or if a great number of the ruling families or even the populace are destroyed, then that would be a reason for those things to happen. But other than that, I can't see any reason for them to particularly merge.
Part of why I ask is mainly because I think the resurrection of Malkier is contingent upon Lan surviving. And Nynaeve did an amazing thing by getting the Golden Crane flying again. Whether, you know, Lan fully realizes the depth of what she's, I want to say, done to him, but also done for him, I don't know if it's struck home yet. And I'm not wondering if seeing so many of the Malkiri alive and fighting behind him, or, you know, riding to Tarmogaidon with him, might not spark something which ultimately is going to trigger that need to live. Because Lan still, for all he has, it's only when he's directly with Nynaeve in the most romantic manner that he loses the warder-severing death frenzy, essentially, because he's been a dead man walking since Moraine fell through the gateway in Kyrian. And it's just an interesting thing, is that I'm not wondering if something needs to be done to snap him out of it. And I'm thinking if he snaps out of it, that might actually cause that, you know, well, if I can come back from the dead, maybe my kingdom can too. I do also think that some of the other borderlands are going to fall. I've already said I think Saldias will survive. I kind of see a lot of the Borderland rulers, because they are not with their nations, being at the last battle physically, and I see a lot of them dying in the last battle, probably because they're going to be right in the thick of it where they're needed most.
Well, personally, I'm hoping for Tenobia to go. I don't really like her that much. So, about Carrion, did we really discuss what we think will happen to Carrion? Do we think it's going to be merged into Andor? If Elaine does not survive, then she has no claim to the Sun Throne. And one of the things that, this is sort of in the nature of a crazy theory, and it just dawned on me as I'm reading through The Shadow Rising for the umpteenth time, something that never occurred to me before, but Tom points out the fact that Moraine Damodred is actually the youngest half-sister to Tarangale, who was the father to Galad and Gawain and Elaine. So that actually makes Elaine and Gawain and also Galad close kin to Moraine. And if enough of the other ruling parties or ruling family of Carrion fall during the last battle, she might possibly be in line for the throne. And if Elaine doesn't survive, perhaps she'll take over Carrion. And at what point in time is Elaine going to realize this? Because I don't think she's realized it yet. I'm sure Moraine must know, because she knows Elaine's heritage really well, but I'm not sure that Elaine has realized that about Moraine. And actually, technically, that might make Moraine an extended member of the royal family of Andor, whose bloodline is crucial to Tarmon Gaiden. Maybe she'll bring back something from the Fin that will turn the tide.
Now, if I remember correctly, the talks of how to deal with Andoran royalty, even if Moraine did have aspirations for the throne, which, as was mentioned, if I remember correctly, in New Spring, she has absolutely zero want or need of the throne. I mean, she ended up, as soon as she got the shawl, basically going off in her blue Aja away to follow her cause and get the heck out of Dodge while she could, before she ended up getting roped into something she didn't really want to be roped into. So I don't think that she has any aspirations of any throne, Carrion or Andoran.
Well, I don't think she has any aspirations toward the throne of Andor, but she might be persuaded to take over Carrion if things fall the right way, and particularly since it's extremely possible that the White Tower might fall, and then she won't have that to fall back on. And if it doesn't fall, it will certainly be greatly changed by all the new alliances and different things that are going on between the Black Tower and the White Tower and the Rebels, and now we have Rebel Ashaman. And then we have the Shan Chan threatening to destroy the White Tower and salt the ground that it sits on. I mean, there's a lot going on there. We don't know what's going to happen. If the White Tower doesn't survive, perhaps Moraine could be persuaded to take over the ruling of Carrion, which is going to be in tatters, because it's already in tatters. It's going to be even worse after Tarmon Gaiden.
I think, too, that Moraine had the... When she was younger, she was a newly raised Aes Sedai. She wanted to go off and find the Dragon Reborn. She's found the Dragon Reborn. She's done all of that. She's been captured and held prisoner. By the time she gets out, she might want to essentially retire to the comfort of being something as simple as the Queen of Carrion. I think that now that she's had her opportunity to fight for her cause and hopefully, you know, cross her fingers, help her cause succeed in the last battle, then she might really enjoy going to go rule there.
Especially if Tom goes along with her. He'll either be her husband or her court bard, I think, one of the two. Or possibly her warder, I don't know. But I think there's something going to go on there. He certainly knows plenty about ruling a country.
And he is a master at the game of houses, so...
Wouldn't that be funny? Tom Marilyn, King of Carrion?
The Grey Fox and the Blue Lady ruling the Kingdom of Carrion. That's an interesting image.
Well, it's pretty ironic, too, when you consider that Tom was the one that killed Galdrian, the last king.
Whose family line was opposed to the Demodreds. So technically, paved the way for a revival of House Demodred.
Exactly. And actually, Tom's pretty good at taking care of kings and wannabe kings, because he killed Tarangale, too. Or we presume he did.
I don't remember him doing that, but then again, there's a lot of backstory I need to do a lot more reading on.
Well, Tarangale died very conveniently when Tom was court bard of Andor and Queen Morghese's court, and there was a plot in play for Tarangale to become the first king of Andor, and then he just very conveniently died, and it was very strongly implied that Tom Marilyn had something to do with that.
Well, we know that Tom uncovered this plot. The sort of, it was pretty strongly implied that Tarangale was going to murder his wife, or have her assassinated, rather, to pave his way. And it's one of those things that I can kind of see. I believe Tarangale died in a hunting accident, and the words hunting accident in literature all over the place, dating back to the Middle Ages, has often been really synonymous for, I'm going to go out and make sure this person doesn't come back.
Oh, absolutely. And Tom is also a master of that, because we know that in the Tyran High Lords, he arranged for Carleon to die in a hunting accident, killed by his best friend Todosian, and Moraine actually brought that up to him when she was talking to him.
Yeah, well, all that really proves is the fact that Tom is essential for this series to keep on going, before, during, and after the last battle. And I don't think anybody, listener, podcaster, writer, anything of the like, would disagree with that statement.
I can't. I hope he does. He's one of my favorite characters.
What, you hope that he vanishes? Tisk, tisk,
no, I
tisk,
hope that
tisk.
He continues on. I like Tom.
Oh, okay. Whew.
Oh, no! So where does this leave Rand in all of this post-Tarmogoyf madness, assuming that he survives? Do you think he will survive? Do you think he's going to take over the ruling of a nation? Is he going to, if he survives, is he going to retire into obscurity? Or will he be, you know, Elaine's consort, and Min and Avienda will be hanging around doing his every whim, bidding, whatever?
Don't forget that he's also the Karakarn, at least I think that's how it's pronounced, the chief of clan chiefs. So, I mean, if all else fails, he can fall back to the Aiel, he can fall back to Ilion, where he is the properly anointed and crowned king of Ilion. He can fall back on Tyr, which he's conquered multiple times, he can fall back on Kyrian, which he's conquered. He's got a lot of places he can fall back on if he survives.
So, do we have any other thoughts on this exciting post-Tarmogoyf discussion? Actually, I think it's pretty cool so far. We've come up with a lot of stuff I hadn't really thought about. I like it. What else is left? Altara? Shara? What about...
Tanchico is going to fall into the ocean, along with most, if not half, of, if not all, of Eridomen. Both of them are going to just... done. Either going to fall
no
into the ocean, fall into the mountains or rise up, but they're going to be gone.
No more Domani? Oh my god!
Yeah, no more walking around looking like a prostitute.
I would have thought you would have wanted them to stick around. Come on.
Well, I think enough of them have escaped into other countries and that. I think a lot of the forces, or a lot of, not the forces, but a lot of the people of a lot of those coastal countries and that have started moving inward in response to the Seanchan colonization. And as a result, yeah, I kind of agreed with Mark. I think those nations are going to be lost in the upheaval after the last battle, but their people, you know, more or less will survive.
Yeah, because, I mean, if I remember correctly, in, I think it's Crossroads as well as Knife of Dreams, Fael and Perrin are talking about all the immigrants coming across the Mountains of Mist into the Two Rivers and bringing with them all these really crazy trades and fashion statements and this and that and the other thing. So, I mean, the culture will probably survive, but the nations won't.
Okay, as long as I can still get Domani food, because I really like that, and I use the Sura really well. The Sursa.
I don't use them. I couldn't use them to save my life. I still can't. But
I have my own
Sursa. But take their clothing, especially all that sheer stuff, because, quite frankly, women need to actually have some aspect of decency left to them. Not bare everything or almost bare everything so that there's nothing left to the imagination, because what the heck's the point of having clothing if there's nothing left to imagine underneath? But that's beside the point. Get rid of the clothing.
Get rid of the haughtiness,
the haughty, arrogant attitude, and we'll be good.
Well, I like the food, but I have to say I couldn't wear the clothing even to bed. That would be a little bit too much for me. But they are good traders, don't forget that.
I couldn't sport a Domani mustache to save my life. Hell, I can barely get a goatee to grow, let alone a mustache.
I thought that was the Terrabonners that had those weird mustaches. Did the Domani have them too? I didn't think so.
I don't know.
The Saldans have weird mustaches too.
One of the two had a funky mustache, and I think you're right, it might have been the Terrabonners. But no, get rid of that. I can't do that, so... done. Introduce them to this lovely invention known as the razor.
No, but they have razors, only their horses, you know?
Yeah, introduce them to, like, the Gillette Fusion Turbo 5-blade.
Yeah, the idea of those Terrabonner mustaches underneath the veils of, you know, mesh and the veils of silk and all that is so ludicrous. I can't even imagine how lame that must look.
I can imagine it, and yes, it is kind of lame, but again, that's just moi.
From actually having worn chainmail, long hair of any sort really needs to have something else over it. Otherwise, chainmail plus any amount of length in any sort of hair, be it facial or top of your head, really bad idea. Really, really, really bad idea.
Yeah, that's going to get caught.
It hurts. No, I don't even want to think about how much that would hurt. That's just, ooh.
Well, clothing and body hair aside, I don't think that those two countries are going to fall into the ocean, as you put it. I think that they're going to essentially be created into new countries, or either many new ones or one big one. But I think that all of those Shanchen that have come here as a part of the return are not going home. Especially not going home to a land that's ravaged by civil war and has no more imperial family. I think they're here to stay, and I think that's where they're going to end up.
Yeah, they're going to be impossible to root out, for one thing.
Exactly. They're not necessarily the Shanchen, I guess for lack of a better word, their government or their ruling structure, but I think that those people aren't going anywhere. I think they're going to have to end up somewhere, and I think that the lands that have been conquered the longest, where they are the most settled, is where they are going to end up.
That seems really reasonable to me. Our last nation, basically, that we have to think about surviving Ptarmigan would be the Aiel. Do we think that they are going to survive in the same form that they are now? How changed are they going to be? I've even heard somebody bring up the idea that the remnant of a remnant that might be saved could be the Shido, who are presently headed back to the Threefold Land. Personally, I hope that's not true, because I really don't like the Shido that much. But I hope the Aiel survive. I think they will. I think they're going to be very changed, and I think they're going to be leaning more back toward the Daishane Aiel that they were in the previous Age of Legends, because it says that Rand will slay them with the leaf and take them back to what they were before, and that seems to be what's happening to me. What do you guys think?
I'm 99% positive that the Aiel nation will survive. I mean, they've shown the tenacity to survive from well into the beginnings of the Age of Legends, if not before that. I mean, they were the Djen back then, they were Daishane, and they were instrumental back then in keeping stuff and helping survive and stuff, and even though they've changed, they're still out there, they're still around, and they're going to survive.
I would not be surprised if the remnant of the remnant refers to specifically the Wise Ones, and that maybe, not that I think that all of the other Aiel are going to be essentially killed or die off, I think that they will survive, but I don't think that they will be considered Aiel anymore. As Virginia mentioned, they may be all considered essentially Shido, or they may merge some of the clans together into something. But I have always kind of suspected that the remnant of a remnant refers specifically to the Wise Ones, because they are the most like the original Aiel as any of the Aiel are now.
As for myself, I honestly see there being two nations. I see there being the Shido nation, which returns to the Blight and lives as the Aiel of the present. And I see the Aiel nation itself, and I actually see that as being a fusion between the Aiel as they exist today and the Aiel of the past. I don't think they will completely go back to being Daishane, that they will bear no weapons anymore. I think they've evolved too far as a people to ever completely regain what they lost when they picked up the weapons in the first place. But I do think that they will ultimately be a cohesive sort of nation, kind of like the various tribes, you know, of the Native Americans coming together as a people rather than their own individual tribes.
I can see exactly where you're coming from there, Andrew, and I would agree. But I think that not just the amalgamation of all the various clans as they are now, but I also think that the Shido will end up getting amalgamated into that Aiel people as well, just because of the fact that he is the chief of chiefs of all of the Aiel, not just those that decide to follow, or that decided at that time to follow him. He has a responsibility to the entire Aiel people, which was, if I remember correctly, partially thrust upon him when he was in his memories, and it was definitely thrust upon him on the slopes of Ruideen, and again on the slopes, or Alkar Dal.
That's definitely a good point. I hadn't actually thought about it that way, and you're right. provided that one of our earlier crazy theories that Galad, being he who comes with the dawn, since he's bearing the golden sunburst on his chest and also being descended from Tigraine, barring that he shows up as the new Karakarn, I do actually kind of see that being the case, where he has to, Rand, as Karakarn, has to be responsible for everyone.
I think the only other thing in this episode, going back to our topic, which I think we stayed pretty cool, we stayed pretty much on track with it tonight. I think the only thing we really didn't discuss was the Aes Sedai versus the Ashaman issue, and I think that could almost be a topic for another episode. We ought to mention the Fourth Age Wheel of Time podcast is enjoying its second anniversary, and thanks to all of the people who have been listening and supported us, it's really fun.
It's hard to believe we've been about this for 2 whole years now. Andrew, I believe, is the one who's been around the longest, so congrats to you, good sir. Props to you and Virginia, who've kept this thing going so long, and Jason and everyone else involved.
And Andrew Miller, who's our producer and sometime voice talent.
Yep, and we hope to be getting the others back, Jason, Carrie, and all of them, as periodic guest hosts again. I've spoken to a couple of them here in the past week or so, and it's really just a matter of finding a time when they can get together with us, but they all would definitely like to come up and do more shows with us whenever they're able to.
I thought it would be really great. I hope that'll happen.
Well, thanks again, everybody, for taking the time out of your busy schedule to give us a listen. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, compliments, insults, although we prefer not to have too many of those, corrections, etc., etc., you can always get a hold of us on our website at www.dragonmount.com/podcast. Just click on any of the links and follow it along and leave us a comment. I know that Virginia is always there making comments and replying to people. I make my presence known as soon as I can or as often as I can. So you can always get a hold of us there.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to have you here tonight, and we've had a lot of fun. You can also reach us at our email address, which is podcast@dragonmount.com. And we also want to take this moment to thank Dragonmount, who is our host and allows us to come to you, and Jason, for all the hard work that he's done on the Dragonmount website, which has predated this site by a number of years. I think it's on its 7th year now, or 8th year. I'm not sure. But anyway, it's a great site, www.dragonmount.com, and thank you for listening.
We also greatly appreciate voicemail messages, which can be left on our number, which is 888-333-7690. That's 888-333-7690. And we'd love to hear your ideas, your comments, your suggestions, or just give us a call and say hi.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. It would be really great to have some voicemail messages. We can include them in the podcast, and you'll be a part of the recording. Andrew, Jesse, and Mark, thank you all for being here. Maybe we'll have 2 more good years.
Thank you, Virginia. It has been a lot of fun. I just want to say one more time that I am really excited to be here. This is a really great experience, and I really enjoy doing it, and I do hope that we get to do it for 2 more years.
Absolutely. Once again, we'd like to thank you all for listening. For myself, Andrew Gellos, Mark, Jesse, Virginia, and all of the podcasters who work here at the Fourth Age, we'd just like to say, Saravya Ninto, Manshima, Daishite.